You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Coke Industries touches the lives of Americans on a daily basis, and yet until Charles and David Koch helped bankroll the Tea Party movement, little was known about this intensely private family from the Midwest. Now, Daniel Shulman, senior editor in the Washington Bureau of Mother Jones, has written Sons of Wichita, How the Koch Brothers Became America's Most Powerful and Private Dynasty, an in-depth look at all four Koch brothers, including the lesser-known Bill and Frederick, their parents, their businesses, their politics, and the many years they spent in court suing one another for control of Koch Industries. It is published by Grand Central Publishing, and I'm very pleased that it brings Daniel to our show today. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Much has been written about their fellow conservative power brokers, Roger Ailes, Rupert Murdoch, Richard Mellon Scaife, but the Koch brothers, who are richer than all of them put together, have remained somewhat of a mystery. Did they stonewall you when you were working on the book in the same way that they stonewalled Jane Mayer when she was writing about them for The New Yorker?
Well, so I started out by writing letters to all four of the brothers, explaining what I was doing and asking for an audience with them, essentially. Charles and David, these letters ended up in the hands of their public relations department, and this began a sort of long dialogue with them that continued throughout the process.
But you were alerting them to the fact that you were working on it.
Yes. And I would say that they were as helpful as they thought they could be. They made certain people at the company available to me, and I certainly appreciated that help. In terms of Bill Koch, he did not want to cooperate at all. And his PR handler, in fact, said that talking to me would be like slitting his own throat. That's almost a direct quote. Frederick Koch, who's the eldest of the four Koch brothers, he received my letter and he actually gave me a call, invited me over for a tour of his this really fabulous townhouse he owns on the Upper East Side.
Jackie Onassis's place?
This is actually a former Woolworth mansion.
Wow.
It was Jesse Donahue's mansion. It was Woolworth built three mansions on East 80th Street for each of his daughters when they were married. So Frederick bought one of those in the 80s.
And it's kind of like a museum, isn't it?
It basically, he doesn't even live there. It's just a place where he spent millions restoring this place, and he's got fabulous art, including, I should say, the most rare piece in the house is Marie Antoinette's bed.
How did Koch Industries get to be the second largest privately held corporation in the United States?
You know, at the time that Charles Koch started running, after their father's death in 1967, that's when he's really running this company on his own. It was basically a mid-sized oil and cattle ranching empire. His first transaction was in 1968 was really the acquisition that fueled its future expansion, and this was consolidating control over a refinery in Minnesota that had access to Canadian crude oil and also access to the Midwestern market. There wasn't much competition there. They used this to fuel their expansion into petrochemicals. And from there on into sort of fertilizer, at this point, it's not an oil company anymore. It's an electronics company. It's a papermaking company.
They own Georgia-Pacific.
They own Georgia-Pacific.
And they own spandex, don't they?
They own Lycra, yes.
Lycra.
Yeah,
so,
the brand, yeah.
But which goes way beyond the oil business.
Sure.
Didn't their father build the company from scratch? Pretty humble beginnings.
Yeah, their father grew up in the panhandle of Texas, was the son of a frontier newspaper man, not a very wealthy clan. He goes off to Rice University and then MIT to study chemical engineering. And in his mid-20s, he ends up forming a partnership with a couple of other oil engineers, a company called Winkler Koch Engineering. And they begin selling a process for refining oil around the Midwest.
And he marries Mary, who comes from a very well-to-do family.
She comes from a well-to-do family. And at this point, he had become a wealthy man in his own right. In the early 1930s, his company landed a contract with the fledgling Soviet Union. This was at a time when we didn't even have diplomatic relations with the USSR. And
that's because he felt that he had been pushed out of the U.S. market and he needed to find another market?
It's an interesting story because the fellows he went into business with were engineers for a company called Universal Oil Products, which was at that time owned a patented refining technology. And it was able, it was something called thermal cracking, which was totally new. It enabled you to basically get more oil, more gas out of a barrel of oil. Essentially, Fred's company, Fred Koch's company, started selling a very, very similar process to the one to Universal Oil Products, and they sued as a result. But the result was that they had to find contracts outside of the U.S., and that's how they ended up finding work in the USSR.
In Stalin's USSR.
In Stalin's USSR.
Was it a big success?
Well, it's basically the seeds of the family fortune. His company earns $5 million, a huge amount of money at that time, for modernizing 15 oil refineries.
Now, he was also already politically conservative. So can we say that this was the beginning of his strong anti-communist feelings?
Oh, absolutely. He spent 3 months over in the Soviet Union, and he was appalled by what he saw there. And I think he did harbor some guilt for playing a pretty vital role in helping to industrialize the Soviet Union, essentially helping to make it into the superpower that it would later become.
And that led him to become one of the founders of the John Birch Society.
Fierce, fierce anti-communist. He was literally present in the room when Robert Welch, the founder of the John Birch Society, laid out his vision to a small group of businessmen.
Was it just anti-communism? Didn't he also envision a vicious race war?
Essentially, basically, this was a strain of thinking that was prevalent in the John Birch Society at that time. They believed that, Soviet provocateurs were whipping up race tensions in the United States. So they thought figures like Martin Luther King were communists, and they saw, a menace in the civil rights movement.
They said that Dwight D. Eisenhower may have been in the pay of the communists. So
Robert Welch thought
far.
He was a communist agent.
Fred Koch was rather tough on his boys. He thought that tough love was the way to bring up kids.
You know, he grew up in a place where an unfortunate turn in the weather could mean the difference between prosperity and poverty. By the time he had his sons, he had become a very wealthy man. He didn't want them to grow up to become what he would say country club bums.
But they lived across
across the street from the country club. So, David Koch tells a story about, doing chores on the family compound and, hearing the laughter of his friends in the country club pool kind of wafting over during summers of backbreaking labor on their property.
Now, he had four boys, and he encouraged sibling rivalry between them. Frederick was the oldest.
Yep.
He was the biggest disappointment because he was effeminate?
It was also that he just was not interested in the family business. He wasn't interested in sports. His interests were art, theater, these sorts of things. And their mother certainly encouraged these interests because she was an artist in her own right. And she has said, that Frederick was in his own world. Their father wanted their sons to work on the family ranches, mucking stalls, digging fence posts and digging holes for fence posts, that sort of thing. Charles has said that Frederick at one point had a nervous breakdown during one summer of labor on one of the ranches.
Well, Frederick liked art, but so does David Koch like art. He has given a lot of money to museums. In fact, hasn't he supplied the money for the new facade of the Metropolitan Museum of Art?
Absolutely. I think in terms of Frederick, their father was a John Wayne-esque figure, gruff, man's man type of guy. And Frederick and he did not relate very well.
Now, it's an interesting group of boys. There are twins, and
yep.
Yet the twins are not close. Usually, the twins wind up being the closest in a family.
Well, David and Bill are the fraternal twins, and fraternal twins, and they certainly were close growing up, but had a very fierce rivalry, as you alluded to earlier. In fact, it was so fierce that their sort of Manny at the time, this guy named Morris, who took care of the property but also squired them around Wichita, carried boxing gloves with him because these guys would get into fights that were so brutal that, they were afraid they were going to hurt each other.
And so it wound up that David and Charles, his older brother, developed the alliance?
They were natural compatriots because both were good at sports. They were popular with girls. Bill, you know, has said that he just really felt like the third wheel almost growing up, and he felt that Charles encouraged a rivalry between he and Bill, he and David.
My guest is Daniel Shulman, who's written a book called Sons of Wichita, How the Koch Brothers Became America's Most Powerful and Private Dynasty. When Fred Koch died in 1967, was there any doubt that Charles would take over the family company?
None.
He was the favorite?
He was, you know, Frederick was not interested in the business. And in fact, there were some episodes in the 60s, according to Charles, where Frederick had stolen from their father. And Fred Koch eventually partially disinherited him, not completely because he'd been given a couple trusts before that. But according to Charles, this was because he'd stolen from their dad and forged Charles's name on the family Brooks brother charge account, of all things.
So since he was disinherited, how does he wind up with money nonetheless?
In the early 60s, he received two trusts. So he was basically ends up owning 14% of Koch Industries at the time, where the other brothers basically got little over 20%.
And Charles made a play for Frederick's share in the company.
It was shortly after.
This is not brotherly love.
Basically, Frederick and Charles never had a very close relationship. And Charles was very intent on having partners in his business that he knew he could work with. I think he saw Frederick as an outlier and, you know, an open question.
And you write that he resorted to a homosexual blackmail attempt to force Frederick to sell his shares.
That was an allegation that Bill actually made, and Frederick has said that, you know, that attempt did not work.
Well, Bill and Frederick have wound up being allies only because they were the ones who were left out.
In essence, you know, basically what leads to this feud is in the late 1970s, Bill Koch, David Koch, Charles Koch are all working for the family company. Charles Koch, of course, is leading the company. The company has run afoul of a number of government agencies, is under scrutiny by the Department of Energy, and then a set of felony indictments come down for fixing a federal oil lottery. Bill and other shareholders in the company are very concerned about the direction it's taking. Bill attributes what's happening to the company to Charles's anti-government libertarian philosophy, because on the side, he's been funding a lot of libertarian causes. They're also concerned about the amount of liquidity, their ability to extract money from the company. You asked about how Koch Industries got so big. One of the reasons is because Charles was plowing all of the profits back into it. So you had a lot of people that were wealthy on paper, could not do the things they wanted to do with their wealth. You know, long story short, there is an attempted boardroom coup staged by Bill, Frederick, and other shareholders that fails. Bill is thrown out of the family company, and this sets the stage for 20 years of battle.
I want to come back to their libertarian side and some of the other aspects of the story that you tell in this book. My guest is Daniel Shulman, senior editor at the Washington Bureau of Mother Jones, founding member of the magazine's investigative journalism team. His book, Sons of Wichita, How the Koch Brothers Became America's Most Powerful and Private Dynasty, it's published by Grand Central Publishing. Stay with us for more. We're back with Daniel Shulman. He's written Sons of Wichita, How the Koch Brothers Became America's Most Powerful and Private Dynasty. It is published by Grand Central Publishing. David Koch once described Koch Industries as the biggest company you've never heard of. How is it possible to keep such a large company hidden for so long?
You know, because they were sort of laboring as a middleman in the oil and gas industry. You weren't necessarily seeing their name plastered on consumer products. You know, now today with the acquisition of Georgia Pacific, they've really ended up entering that consumer product realm. But previous to that, you know, this was a sort of an oil, gas, chemical, cattle ranching company.
But they've decided never to take the company public.
Yes. And that traces back to, you know, in some ways to their libertarian beliefs and their privacy. This is a very private family by nature. They don't want to open themselves up to more financial regulators, frankly, by going public, and they don't want to lose control over the company.
When Charles wrote an op-ed piece for the Wall Street Journal in response to critics like Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, didn't he describe his critics as collectivists? That would suggest that he's still thinking like his father to some degree.
Oh, absolutely, and I think he
does.
But
his father wasn't a libertarian.
His father wasn't a libertarian, though he certainly had, you know, his father may have been a libertarian before libertarians quite existed, because there were a lot of people at the top tier of the John Birch Society that sort of veered off into the libertarian movement of the 1960s, and that's how Charles Koch ends up becoming acquainted with libertarianism. And that's how he ends up deciding to kind of make it the thrust of his philanthropic legacy.
Well, he came under the influence of a radical libertarian named Robert Lefebvre.
Right.
Who was he?
Robert Lefebvre was an anti-government activist, newspaper op-ed editor. And he starts this basically training ground for libertarians in the Rampart Mountain Range of Colorado, something called the Freedom School. Charles Koch and other members of the John Birch Society end up becoming trustees at the school, and this was something that greatly influenced his worldview.
But just Charles and David became libertarians, or all four brothers?
Charles, David, and there was a point where Bill was funding some libertarian causes in the 70s. But he would later say that he sort of viewed, especially Charles's anti-government philosophy, as kind of nutty. Frederick did not adopt any of these views and is actually politically quite liberal.
You write that Charles Koch wants to see a real libertarian revolution in his lifetime. What would that look like?
You know, Charles has in the past said that his ideal government, the maximum role that government should play in our lives, is that of a night watchman, in which you're basically protecting the country from outside threat and protecting the laws of supply and demand in the market economy. That is the maximum. Now, that is not the kind of government we have currently. And if you think of all of the infrastructure this country has that was built by, you know, public investment, the roads, for instance, this is a very different place that he envisions.
Well, he doesn't even envision the United States of George Washington.
No, I don't think so. I mean, basically, people who knew Charles Koch in his libertarian heyday describe him as an anarcho-capitalist, basically somebody with anarchistic tendencies who believes that almost every role of society can be fulfilled by private individuals.
He was asked to run as the Libertarian Party's vice presidential nominee in 1980 and declined.
Yeah, Charles Koch was really the wallet of the libertarian movement of the 1970s. He was a founder of the Cato Institute, and he was also funding a number of other libertarian outfits. He was asked to run, and Charles, of all of his brothers, is one of the most private. And he also had a company to run. So he ends up asking Bill and asking David if they want to run, and David takes him up on it.
Since they are very litigious, including suing each other, were you concerned about writing a biography of them?
You know, it's always something that's in the back of your mind, but I approach this book as I would any other story that I work on, which is just to make darn sure that I'm getting my facts straight and checking as much of the details as I can.
The 1980 election is the one Ronald Reagan won.
Yep.
He is a Republican hero. Now the Kochs are very much part of the Republican Party story, but they were disappointed when they didn't beat Ronald Reagan?
You know, I don't think they ever had any intention of winning that election. The point of David Koch running, and a Koch running at all, was in fact so an individual could pour his own wealth into the campaign, circumventing campaign finance laws. And this enabled the Libertarian Party ticket to get on the ballot in 50 states. And the idea really was to educate the public. They wanted to introduce the world, America, to libertarianism.
Well, doesn't David Koch support same-sex marriage? And don't most libertarians support things like a woman's right to choose, same-sex marriage, lower military spending, the legalization of marijuana. How did the Kochs reconcile that with the positions of most of the Tea Party candidates that they've been funding more recently?
I think it's a marriage of convenience. I think you're absolutely right that David Koch does support gay marriage. These guys are not social conservatives at all. They're kind of moderate on immigration. They're anti-war. They're pro-civil liberties. But you don't see them putting their money where their mouth is on these issues. The place where you really see them advocating is on free market economics, economic ideas, anti-regulatory. And that's where their agenda aligns with the Republicans and the sort of Tea Party faction.
Philip Morris eventually was excluded from supporting a lot of arts organizations because of the cigarette business. The Kochs have become kind of famous as opponents to many of the things that people in the arts might be in support of. How has David Koch been able to work that out?
I think it's a bit of a tightrope, because as you meant, he is extraordinarily generous in the arts. It's hard to walk down the street in New York City without running into something that David Koch's name is.
The New York State Theater is now the David Koch
Theater. The promenade at the Met is going to be named after David Koch. The dinosaur wing at the Natural History Museum is named after David Koch. I talked to a board member at Lincoln Center who basically said, there are a lot of us that don't like his politics one iota. But the fact of the matter is, we needed to get this theater rehabbed, and there aren't that many people standing in line to write $100 million checks.
My guest is Daniel Shulman. His book, Sons of Wichita, How the Koch Brothers Became America's Most Powerful and Private Dynasty, published by Grand Central Publishing. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The 1980 election didn't make the Libertarian Party all that much more important in American politics. So is that when they decided to start creating these various lobbies and political action groups?
Essentially what happens after the 1980 election is that the Libertarian movement essentially implodes. Part of this was because there were elements of the Libertarian movement that didn't believe that David Koch and his running mate staked out a radical enough position. They felt like they were diluting libertarian ideas in order to sell them to the public. This ends up fracturing the movement, which, included some elements that the Kochs found a little bit nutty. So this is when they decide that they'll advance libertarian ideas, but they'll do it outside the formal libertarian movement.
They form the Citizens for a Sound Economy, the precursor to Americans for Prosperity in 1985. Also help fund the Cato Institute?
Yeah, Charles was a founder of the Cato Institute, and David would later become a board member.
And then there was a falling out with them because their politics had moved in such a different direction?
No, this was really a personality clash that occurred between Charles and Ed Crane, who was one of the co-founders of the Cato Institute. David Koch is still a board member of Cato.
Presidents like Reagan and George Bush were very much big government. Why did they not go after them the way they've gone after President Obama?
I think that you have to go to the Clinton administration. What occurred in the 90s was that Koch Industries was under siege by the Clinton Justice Department, Clinton administration, EPA. There were a range of environmental disasters. There was also an episode in which a Koch pipeline exploded, killing two Texas teenagers in really a very, very grisly way. And this ended up resulting in a $296 million wrongful death jury award.
So they blame government rather than themselves?
Well, I think the tie-in here, the reason why this jury award was so big was because the plaintiffs were able to show that essentially Koch Industries was forgoing maintenance and basically saying, there was somebody that testified in a deposition that, if you invested money elsewhere, it might pay off, even if there was a disaster that killed somebody, because you could just come back and pay off the lawsuit. So I think the jurors in this small Texas town were horrified by these sorts of practices. But on the other side, you see the Justice Department and EPA scrutinizing similar occurrences that were happening with the pipelines and that sort of stuff. And the Clinton administration's parting shot to Koch Industries was a 97-count felony indictment targeting employees at its plant in Corpus Christi, Texas. I think when Obama took office, they were fearing a repeat performance.
The Tea Party movement likes to describe itself as a grassroots movement that was inspired largely by CNBC's Rick Santelli's tirade about government bailouts. How did that come to be something quite different, something funded by the Koch brothers? Were the Koch brothers there from the start?
You know, I think that they had been planting a lot of the intellectual seeds all along through a variety of advocacy groups and think tanks that they funded. But really, the role that they played at the dawn of the Tea Party was in providing some of the key organizational and financing support that helped this movement get off the ground. And they did this through their advocacy group, Americans for Prosperity. Another key player was a group called FreedomWorks, which had actually broken off from Citizens for a Sound Economy. And the Kochs were not affiliated with, but it kind of had its origins in their network.
Do most Tea Party leaders, are they perfectly happy to receive this money from the Koch brothers, even though it's obviously very opposite to the message they're sending out?
I don't think that a lot of Tea Party leaders don't receive terribly much money from the Kochs. It's mainly Americans for Prosperity that was involved in setting up some of the Tea Party rallies.
But I think they don't see the connection between Americans for Prosperity and the Kochs?
Oh, no, I think they do. I think they do. But I'm not sure that they care about it.
A year ago, Eric Cantor, the governor of New Mexico, and Paul Ryan secretly spoke to wealthy donors at the Koch brothers' summer gathering in the outskirts of Albuquerque. Won't the defeat of Eric Cantor last night be seen as a defeat for Charles and David Koch?
You know, in some ways, I think that the whole Tea Party strain came back to bite the Kochs in some ways. And you really saw this occur during the 2012 election when you had candidates like Todd Akin, who caused a major backlash among voters. And you can attribute that some of that to this sort of Tea Party insurgency that occurred on the political scene. And certainly, I think there's a lot of instant analysis of what occurred with Eric Cantor going down in defeat yesterday.
Despite being so much better funded than his opponent.
Massively better funded.
How did Charles and David create a dark money network to fund the Tea Party? Is that one of their major legacies today?
You know, they've created a pretty enormous political network. I basically call it a shadow party because they have all the capabilities of a political party. They have the ability to raise as much as the Republican National Committee. And in fact, in the 2012 election, they raised more than $400 million. The RNC also raised $400 million. They have a voter micro-targeting operation. They have groups like Americans for Prosperity that both have get-out-the-vote capabilities in all the major electoral districts and the ability to, you know, blanket the airwaves with ads.
And yet Barack Obama won the election. Karl Rove did not believe it on national television. What about the Koch brothers?
Oh, I think they were pretty convinced that they had this one in the bag. And, you know, from conservative political operatives that I've talked to, the Kochs were telling their donors, you know, that they had this one. You know, obviously their efforts were quite a major failure in 2012.
So they, I would think that they would say, this is not the right approach. Let's pack up our bags and move on, try something else. But they're still at it, aren't they?
I think they're recalibrating. The one thing about the Kochs, and you see this also in the way that they conduct their business, is that they learn from their mistakes. They're not sentimental about a certain approach or a certain business. If it's not working, they cut their losses. You know, the reckoning after 2012, I found, was quite muted. But I think 2014 is really going to be the make or break moment for them. If they can't retake the Senate, which is really the thrust of what they're doing, then I think you'll see a major recalibration in their network.
They're not the only people putting their money into this. A lot of their friends are also putting money into this. And so they're counting on these off-year elections for a major change. What do they hope to accomplish? Why are they so opposed to Obamacare?
You know, these guys are just free market, libertarian, true believers. They don't believe that the government should have a role in things such as the healthcare system. They, in fact, don't believe that there should be things like entitlements and things of that nature. So they're against anything that is emanating from the federal government at that level.
And they are credited with masterminding the 2013 government shutdown over the debt ceiling.
There were certainly
Would they have gained by that?
I don't think that. Well, I think this was against. You know, these guys are huge on cutting government spending. So this was sort of a Waterloo moment there. You know, I wouldn't say that they necessarily masterminded it, but they were. But Americans for Prosperity during the first debt ceiling showdown was out there with a number of other conservative groups, you know, calling for the Republicans to reject any compromises.
Well, they are, you say they're cutting their losses and looking for new approaches, but do you expect them to be back in the next election?
Oh, without a doubt. In fact, they're going to be doubling down.
Rand Paul, because he's the most libertarian?
You know, Rand Paul is an interesting case because there was a lot of libertarian infighting that occurred in the 1980s, and the Kochs and Ron Paul, his father, ended up on two different sides of that. So they're not necessarily big Ron Paul fans, but you're right that their politics do line up pretty well with Rand Paul's.
Daniel Shulman's book, Sons of Wichita, How the Koch Brothers Became America's Most Powerful and Private Dynasty, is published by Grand Central Publishing. Thank you so much for being on our show.
My pleasure.